Hello, everyone. It's Dan Budnick. Daniel R. Budnick. Known to friends as Dan Budnick. I am not the award-winning photographer. I am the almost, but not quite, award-winning author. In dreams, baby. In dreams. Welcome to episode 47 of Eventually Super Trade. Woohoo! We are covering... What are we covering? Who knows? We are covering the 15th episode of Green Hornet, the 3rd episode of Bourbon Street Beat, and the 13th episode of Ellery Queen Mysteries. So we're going, what is it, 66, I think it's like December 66 to October 59, possibly November 59 to January of 76. Woohoo! Good times, good times. I want to apologize to folks. The last few episodes, life and such have been a little confusing as the past few episodes have been made, and also very busy. I think I mentioned that my contract for my next book has been signed, and I'm trying to figure out exactly how to get it all written in time. And so things are taking up a lot of time. Things are taking up a lot of space in my mind and such. So the last few episodes have been a bit odd. I apologize, everyone. I can assure you, I can 85% assure you that the next episode, episode 48, will be back to normal and awesome. This episode's going to be awesome. Trust me, this episode's going to be awesome. But we'll get back to normal with the next one. So all awesome, back to normal for the next one. Again, my apologies. But please enjoy this little bit of Green Hornet.
Another challenge for the Green Hornet. His aide, Cato, and their rolling arsenal, the Black Beauty. On police records, a wanted criminal, the Green Hornet is really Britt Reed, owner publisher of the Daily Sentinel. His dual identity known only to his secretary and to the district attorney. And now, to protect the rights and lives of decent citizens, rides the Green Hornet.
Thank you, Green Hornet players. Thank you once again. May the best man lose. I know what you're thinking. Dan, that's an episode of Charles in Charge. You talking Charles in Charge on here now? No. We are talking Green Hornet episode... Good gravy, we're on episode 15 of the Green Hornet now. Wow. December 23rd, 1966. Merry Christmas to you. Written by Judith and Robert Guy Barrows. That's Judith Barrows and Robert Guy Barrows. It's not Judith Guy Barrows and Robert Guy Barrows. And directed by Alan Reisner. This one begins... Well, it's time to re-elect the DA in Scanlon. We're at Scanlon campaign headquarters, and we see a kind of dumpy sort of looking guy poking around in what is, we will find out in a moment, is Scanlon's car. He is up to something in this car, something that is no good. Scanlon comes on out. He's getting in the car to take off. This skeezy guy is hanging out like in an alley. A gentleman named Dave Quincy comes out and says, Scanlon, you got to get on the phone with someone. Okay, Dave, well, hop in my car and deliver these things. Okay, Scanlon goes back to the his office, campaign office. Boom, the car blows up. Dave Quincy's dead. Scanlon is shocked. The credits roll. As the credits wrap up, we see Green Hornet and Cato get in the car and they drive around the streets of the city for a bit, and they see an upside down campaign poster. And Hornet sprays a little spray paint X. All of a sudden, the dumpy bomber guy shows up, and he gets in the car with Hornet and Cato.
Name?
Starkey. Jack Starkey.
You mean you're it? The big plot against Scanlon?
Just me. What's your proposition?
Pull over and let Mr. Starkey out.
Wait a minute. You dropped word you wanted to help get rid of Scanlon.
I don't deal with little people, Starkey.
But I did what you wanted. I flipped the poster for the signal. Man, you act like we sent for you.
You just said the key word, we. Who do you work for?
I told you, just me.
Listen, Starkey. Even a fish that smells as bad as you has a head. Who is it?
A guy.
What guy?
A guy, that's all. Just a guy.
Give him a message for me. Tell him I don't deal with subordinates.
Oh, wait a minute. I don't think that you...
You don't have to think. Just tell him what I said. Pull over.
Hey, where do we find you?
We'll find you.
So as that happens, they're parallel back at the Sentinel. Scanlon and his opponent, Calvin Ryland, are having a debate.
Which may not answer your question, Mr. Carey, so I'll try to be straight with you.
My opponent, Mr. Ryland, has made much of the fact that during my years in office, I've been unable to apprehend the Green Hornet.
Well, now, it's just a matter of public record, Mr. Scanlon. I mean, after all, you are the incumbent district attorney. You know better than I what steps have been taken to apprehend that notorious criminal.
Mr. Ryland, members of the press, I want to assure you that everything necessary is being done to bring the Green Hornet to justice.
Mr. Axford.
Mike Axford, Daily Sentinel. My question's for Mr. Ryland. What's your reaction, sir, to the rumors, you'll excuse me for putting it this way, that your campaign organization is responsible for placing a bomb in Mr. Scanlon's car and for the murder of Dave Quincy?
Well, if I may say...
Mr. Ryland, let me answer that for you, if you don't mind. Even though Mr. Ryland wants to defeat me for the office of district attorney, his honor is beyond reproach. Now, I've known him for years. And to suggest that he or anyone in his organization would try to remove me from office by any other than the democratic process is utterly ridiculous. I'm deeply shocked at Mr. Axford's question.
And this brings to a close another of our weekly programs, Debate the Issues.
And the conference ends, and poor Mike, and Calvin and Scanlon chat for a bit. We'll meet Warren, who is Calvin's brother, who is the campaign manager for Calvin. And we intercut, as I said, with Green Hornet and Cato following the bomber into a warehouse where there were two other thugs in there waiting for their boss to show up. And Green Hornet and Cato beat the crap out of these guys. And then the boss shows up, and it's a moment, sort of. I'm not going to say what happens right here, because this is the third time I'm trying to record me saying this, and every time I've said the name of the person who is the head bad guy, and I'm trying to keep that spoiler-free. So I'm going to stop, actually, my plot discussion right here, and just say it involves the Green Hornet going on a bit of a crime wave, I put that in quotes, tear, to discredit Scanlon, which winds up with the Hornet in a bank at noon, possibly about to get blown up by a bomb set by the bad guy in the bomber at 12:02. So we're going to go to that more. We're going to spoil the heck out of it. It's really not much to spoil, but it was kind of a moment where I was like, oh, wow, they revealed that in a sort of a strange spot. So I'm gonna take a deep breath, and we are going to talk this episode of Green Hornet. Before I dive fully in, I just want to kind of point out that I have been trying to find those freaking files that Kristen and I recorded for these past few episodes and this one. And for this one, it was weird. I found one brief snippet, and that was it. I don't know where the heck the rest of it went, but here it is. Once again, thank you so much, Kristen. This has been a whole lot of fun.
Well, thanks, Dan. I've been having fun, too. And I just want you to know that if you lose one of these files, I will find out where you live, I will come to your house, and I will kick you in the crotch.
And that's all we got of that, unfortunately. Bit of a heartbreaker, that. Again, I screwed up, everyone. If you're hearing this episode as it comes out fresh, you're hearing me. But there's a good chance if you're listening to this again, maybe 4, 5, 6 months later, a year later, or if you're a brand new listener going through this long after this episode went up, which would have been around June 1st of 2018, you might not be hearing this at all. You might not be. I'm still looking for the tapes. But again, my apologies. I'm going to dive into my chatter. I'm not going to go crazy. I'm just a little bit of chatter on May the Best Man Lose. I like the opening sequence with the bomb. It is one of those ruthless moments that this show is filled with. I don't know if they were trying specifically to say, okay, we have to make this as unlike Batman as possible, which is definitely going to start to seem weird in about 7 or 8 episodes when a little something special happens with Batman. But, it is ruthless. You see this guy putting in something, setting it up, what's clearly a bomb. Scanlon goes in there and says, okay, Dave, you go for me. And then Dave explodes. And, it explodes. He's dead. It's as awful as the sequence with the missiles or the rockets and the armor at that Beautiful Dreamer Part 2, the armored car blowing up. It's just like, this show is freaking ruthless. And the interesting thing this time is that the Green Hornet really does do any ruthless stuff in this. It's a very strangely structured episode, which, again, we will talk about in a moment. I love there is a moment where, I mean, most of the streets, the majority of the streets that this show is shot on, in fact, almost all of them are studio streets. And as we've said on here before, the way you can always spot a studio street is when you're looking down the street, if it ends with like a row of buildings so you can't sort of see it going off into the distance, or if it curves in one direction, that's most likely a studio street. I just watched Special Delivery. Is it Paul Wendkos? Made a lot of TV movies. It's starring Cybill Shepherd and Bo Svenson. A lot of great faces. And that one takes place sort of on... I'm not sure which studio it is. I've forgotten now. Warner Brothers? Paramount? And a lot of it takes place in a second floor apartment. Like overlooking like a storefront kind of thing, looking down. I won't tell you too much, but it's sort of looking down into like an intersection, and quite a bit of it is spent in and around this intersection, which is a studio lot. And I always love when they do stuff like that. There's something. I was an extra for quite some time, and there's something very, very comfortable about a studio lot, day or night. You know, leaving a set at like 2 a.m. and walking through the lot. It's so nice, but. I say that because there's a moment where the camera is sort of in front of Scanlon's car, and you could sort of see the Mad Bomber hiding over in the far left in between the campaign building and the building next to it, and Scanlon's coming out, and the camera kind of moves a bit. And when the camera moves, you can see like one of the big studio buildings. You know, like soundstage number 14, you can kind of see it poking out. You can see like the silhouette of it in between the buildings, which is lovely. So we get this opening scene, and then Hornet and Kato driving around. They have, completely got rid of all the checklist and the spinning of the car and everything like that, more or less, that was in the early episodes, which stands to reason. Now we're in episode 15, second half of the season. I don't know if at this point they knew if the show was going to continue or not, but they've kind of jettisoned some of that. You fine-tune the shows as they go along. And yeah, they're out driving, and they do the thing where they flip the poster, and then you heard the scene with the guy. And then we kind of get the interesting structure of it up until the point with the big reveal, which I'm sorry, I did not write down when the big reveal happens. I want to say in this like 26-minute episode, it's maybe like 13, 14 minutes in. And I don't think it's before that. It might be a little bit after that. I'm sorry. I should have written it down. And I did not. Maybe I'll get it for you later. But the way it works is sort of it intercuts. Well, it's interesting too because I guess the whole thing takes place over probably a little over a day and a half, because the car bomb thing is sort of in the evening. I don't know what day it is. Let's say it's a Monday evening, and then when we, after the credits, it's the next night, and Hornet and Kato are searching for some kind of clue, and as they are meeting up with the bomber and then following the bomber, that is intercut with a debate which is happening at the same time, and then at the end of all of that, when they meet the bad guy, he says, I think tomorrow at noon. And it ends like there's a wrap-up scene where they all laugh at Mike. In fact, here it is.
Although I'm deeply grateful to the many people who have supported me during this long campaign, I most regretfully have no choice but to withdraw my name. I commend you to Mr. Frank Scanlon, an excellent district attorney.
That's too bad, Britt. He's a good man. I only hope that the mayor can convince him to stay on as Commissioner of Public Works.
Now that he's got his brother off his back, he can do a good job.
Yeah.
You know something, Britt? Next election, you ought to run for office. A good political campaign might liven things up around here.
Mike. So, well, yeah, I will say it as an official spoiler. Yeah, it's the brother. It's the brother, Warren, who in fact is the only other person we meet apart from Calvin and the bomber. So you would imagine it would be him. And it's not that much of a surprise. We could talk the way it's sort of structured once that happens to the end in a moment. But yeah, it intercuts between the debate, and as that's going on, then intercuts with Hornet and Kato finding out where the Mad Bomber's going, and then it all sort of ends with the reveal that it's Warren, and you know, Green Hornet does his. We're going to get a cut on this together, and I'm going to be part of all this, and we're going to do this crime spree. And You know, obviously Warren says, you know, hey, yeah, we'll go to this bank tomorrow and be there at noon, and that'll be great and whatever. And of course, Hornet talks with Scanlan and says, oh, yeah, they're going to double-cross us somehow. Yeah, and they got a bomb planted in the bank vault room that's going to go off at 12:02. And it's a nicely done suspense scene in the bank vault, and Kato gets to yell a bit, and the Hornet gets to build the suspense and build the suspense, which is really nice. And I think it's a real fun episode. I think we've discussed the pacing of some of these episodes, and some of them are sort of paced perfectly, like bullets just pace right on. Some of them the pacing is a little off, like they're a little, they just feel maybe a little too fast. And then occasionally, like Beautiful Dreamer Part 2, they feel a little too slow for what they're doing. This one feels odd in a different way, because up until the point where Warren and the Hornet hash out their plan, it all kind of goes along at a really nice pace. You're learning, you're building, the Hornet and Kato are getting closer to the heart of what's going on as we're meeting Ryland and his brother, Calvin Ryland and his brother Warren, and seeing what they're up against with Scanlan. And then this little plot is set up. But then it's like suddenly it's over. I mean, I think it's literally when Green Hornet leaves, there's maybe 7 or 8 minutes left in the episode. Suddenly it's like they're at the bank and it's over. And it's really weird, because it feels like this one feels like maybe, I don't know, it feels like maybe it was a two-parter or something, or maybe it was written longer. I don't know. It just feels structured very odd, because the first, it's not quite two-thirds. The first, say, 15 minutes are really nicely put together. Then the last 10 are just like, whoa, it's over, huh? And it's a bit too fast. It's a bit, things happen a bit too, like, hey! And it just feels strange. And I do wonder, again, if maybe they were writing these as hour-longs, or maybe some of them had been, maybe this was written as a Batman script or something, and it was two 25-minute episodes, and then they decided to make it a Green Hornet. I don't know, but it just, the structure is so weird. You know, and then it was like, okay, well, we really like the way this bit is structured, so we'll take it up to here, but then we gotta cut out all this stuff in sort of the second half and just go right to the end. You know, like, I mean, part of it too is like they say, well, the Green Hornet's going to do this. I'm going to do this big crime wave. But he only does one thing. He goes to the bank and they already have the bomb set up to blow him up. And it's strange, because it's sort of, you know, you would think maybe, I mean, well, it saves the Green Hornet, because then he doesn't actually have to commit any crimes. He is stopped before he committed any crimes, and the bad guy is caught and brought to justice. Which I guess, In one respect, if you look at it like that, it makes sense. The storytelling makes sense then, because you don't want the Hornet to go out there and commit a crime, and it's sort of intimated that he will be doing so, but it doesn't happen because he's canceled after the one thing. That kind of works there, but at the same time, it's very quick. And I'll say this for the third and final time, but yeah, the structure in the first 12-13 minutes is so nicely done that the structure in like the last 10 minutes or so going so quickly is just such a weird thing. Almost like they, like the first 12 or 13 minutes was episode part one, and was like, oh, maybe not even part one, but like maybe, oh gosh, I don't even know. Okay, here we go. Like maybe the first 12 or so episodes, maybe the original first episode ended with the reveal of who the bad guy was. And then the second part was sort of like a crime wave or this other bit. So say like the first 13 minutes is the first episode, and then the remaining 12 minutes is the second one. But it just ends up feeling really strange. I don't know. It feels like, yeah, it's obviously, I mean, it's not fun. It's a lot of fun to watch. It's a real enjoyable episode. But it's just, you know, we're diving in deep here. We're looking at it just to see what it did, seeing why, you know, why was this a half hour? Why was Batman 2 half hours each, an hour? You know, that kind of thing. And Batman, you know, had trouble hitting the half hours when it got to its third season. So, you know, Green Hornet is got a pretty good track record so far, but this one just feels a little weird to me. But I don't dislike it. It's not a favorite. It definitely has its fun moments. It just feels a little weird to me. After a strong start, it kind of fades a bit in the end. Just a little too swift in the end. But, yeah, that is May the Best Man Lose. And oddly enough, there's barely any Scanlon in it. You'd think there'd be a lot of Scanlon in it, but he shows up in the beginning. He's there for a minute or two of the debate, and then he's got a scene a little later. But, no, it's one of those episodes where no one seems to be in it for a long period of time. Because the episode moves so quickly, and you got Hornet and Kato and Scanlon and Calvin and Warren and the Mad Bomber. It's like no one quite gets enough to do, but then it's over and you can go back and enjoy it again. You know, it's not a filler episode. It's not one of the best. So that is May the Best Man Lose, and let's go down to New Orleans. I didn't insult anyone by saying it like that, did I? New Orleans, we're going down. Let's go down to the Bourbon Street Beat.
Bourbon Street Beat.
Bourbon Street Beat.
Bourbon Street Beat.
Starring Richard Long.
In New Orleans.
Andrew Duggan.
This is the blues.
With Arlene Howell and Van Williams. Produced by Warner Brothers.
Torch Song for Trumpet. The third episode of Bourbon Street Beat aired originally October 19th, 1959. Directed by Leslie H. Martinson, writers James Barnett and Leo Townsend. I'm actually taking that from IMDb rather than the episode itself because I can't find the they're somewhere. I keep missing them. I don't know why I keep missing them, so I went to IMDb. So hopefully those are correct. Does IMDb lie? Never, never. So, this episode begins with a young gentleman in a bar named Sharky's, Sharky's Wharf, and phone rings, he picks it up, and it's a woman on the other end who says his name, which is Kip, and then he pauses, and then he hangs up on her. Then we cut to the Absinthe House, where Cal is sitting down to have dinner, and he's talking with the Baron, and they see a lovely young lady named Cindy Roberts sitting at a nearby table. They know her, and they know that she was once the girlfriend, possible fiancé, with Kip, the gentleman in the bar. And she looks really down. And the Baron kind of fills Cal in that Cal knows this already, but Kip went away for 5 years for burglary. And it's implied that he sort of may have been forced into sort of the gang that he did this burglary with, because Baron says all he cared about was his music and his horn, and I would imagine also Cindy. But they just learned, after he was supposed to do 5 years, Kip was supposed to do 5 years, he got released after two on parole, which seems very good. So Cal goes to talk to Cindy, and Cindy says Kip is working at this horrible dive bar right on the water. Please go talk to him. Cal says, I will. He goes to the bar. He meets a big, husky bartender who says, yeah, he's a relief bartender. He'll be here later. So Cal says, okay. And he kind of stumbles into, half listens, and then stumbles into a conversation between Sharky, who is played by a gentleman named Jay Adler. And Sharky is, he looks like he's maybe in his late 60s, maybe 70. But, I mean, truthfully, he looks around that age, but he sort of has a look to him. He's always sitting down when we see him, and he always looks, he has a feel about him that he's like about like a thousand year old, like a thousand year old zombie or something like that. He just wants to die or something. I don't know. He just looks very gaunt and doesn't look well and always looks very kind of, ah. And there's this big guy named Arlen talking to him. I want you to sell me the place. I want you to sell me the place. And Cal kind of stumbles in, just kind of make sure that nothing untoward is going on. Then Cal leaves, chats with Rex a bit. Rex is making some sort of lovely meal that involves beer. I mean, I know you're saying oxymoron, right, Dan? Lovely meal involves beer. Boom. Two great tastes to go great together. Cal returns to the place, to Sharky's, where Kip is playing a little trumpet. And, oh, and he has seen Kip's when he leaves, pardon me, when Cal leaves after seeing Sharky and Arlen sort of not quite arguing. He sees Kip's horn case, the case with Kip's name on it. So he returns later, talking to Kip, who's been playing some trumpet, and Kip basically says, he doesn't say quite why he's there, but he gives the full skinny on Cindy, which is that about a month after he went in stir, Cindy got married to sort of a rich, well-connected guy, and that's why he's not getting back to her. And Cal leaves and overhears some more of Arlen and Sharky. The same exact thing. Arlen is looming over Sharky, and Sharky's just sitting there going, please let me die. Please let me die. No, he's not really doing that, but he just looks very worried. Then the Cal is basically whomped over the head by the bartender, and the next morning he wakes up like out in the street. They beat him up, threw him, you know, and threw him out of a car. Rex goes over there to check some stuff out, and Cal goes to talk to Cindy, and Cindy tells the story where, yes, she married this guy. He was in love with her. She didn't know if she was in love with him, but she could sort of, he could sort of give her sort of comfort and some security now that Kip was gone. And we learned that Kip and Cindy met when they were sort of, they joined a combo together, and she was singing, he was playing trumpet. It was all he wanted was to play trumpet. She could have cared less. She wanted more and more. And I guess it's intimated that she kind of pushed Kip. And Kip somehow wound up with this gang and ended up in jail. She does say that she's no longer married to this gentleman. They tried, it didn't work. And the last thing he did for her before he left for San Francisco, where he now lives, is he pulled some of the strings he had and got Kip out on early parole. So Cal's ecstatic about this. Hey, maybe it could work. These are two sweet kids. And he goes back to Sharky's, where he finds Sharky dead. The police show up, and, well, it's sort of revealed. Well, I'll tell you two more things, and then we'll go to the chat. One, almost immediately, Arlen buys Sharky's and renames it Arlen's, and Cal and Rex have no idea why he was so intensely intent upon buying that piece of crap bar. And second, when they examine the bruises on Sharky's body when he was beaten to death, they think it was, well, I forget exactly how they describe it, but they sort of say it was something made of copper, and it could have been Kip's trumpet. I'm going to leave it there. I'm going to give you a blast, and the chat will begin. Here we go. Bourbon Street Feet. Jeepers, creepers, Mitchell Hadley, where'd you get those peepers? Hey, everyone, I am here talking Torch Song for Trumpet, the third episode of Bourbon Street Beat with the great Mitchell Hadley. Mitchell, how you doing?
I am just swell. How about you, yeah, Dan?
I'm doing all right. I'm ready to go. Like we mentioned last time, this is the all-important third episode. What will the show be like? Will it have settled in yet? Will we know what's going on? Will there be more Cal? I guess we'll start from the top here. And Mitchell, just give me your broad overview, your thoughts on Torch Song for Trumpet.
Well, there is more Cal in this one. This is the first case where he is the lead. And I think if you've watched 77 Sunset Strip or the other Warner detective shows, you know that they have this habit of alternating the leads in the story. And this is Cal's first case. Although it's important to mention, too, I think that Rex is in the story, just as Cal is in Rex's stories, but it much more so than I think on Sunset Strip. They both have a presence, but this is Cal's first story, and he has some real private detective moments in this where he says the right things and he does the right things, just like a PI would. And also, what I find interesting, and we'll get into this when we go in depth, but he has a personal connection to this case.
Yes.
And the next one in which he is the lead, which we are going to be talking about tonight, but the next one that he leads in, he also has a personal connection. And it will be interesting to see if that becomes a pattern or if it just happened that way, that in two consecutive Cal episodes, he's involved in each case because of a personal interest.
I like seeing more of Cal in this very much. Yeah. I like the actor quite a bit. I looked up his credits and such. I don't know him that much at all. I'm really not familiar with him. So I'm glad I'm getting to know him through this. The fun thing is, because this episode has a more personal feel, for quite a bit of it, apart from some shadiness with Sharky and this shady guy who wants to buy Sharky's bar,
A lot of it feels more like a drama with him trying to connect with this young man who went to prison and trying to possibly get him back together with his gal, and there are dramatic things happening, and there's this side story obviously with this jerk, and I like Mr. Sharkey because he reminds me, like, if Mel Blanc's voiceover career had gone bad and he had ended up like at a bar, like on the wharf. This is that guy. Every time I saw him, I thought, oh, it's like anti Mel Blanc. Like he wouldn't be able to do any voices. He wouldn't be able to do his hair either because it's always like sticking up. But and I like that as the episode goes along, you know, Cal brings in Rex at one point to check some stuff out, and it develops into something rather big. By the end of it, there's something big going on involving this jerk and wanting to take over Sharky's. But for quite a bit of it, it's almost like a drama with Cal just trying to reconnect with these people who seemed like they were a big part of his life at one time, but aren't anymore. And I like that, and I think he's very good with that. And I do like the fact that but by time you get a little over halfway into it and Sharky gets killed, it does start to escalate into, okay, there's something else going on and what's this thing that's happening, and then there's the big ending. So yeah, I thought it was quite charming. Again, as with the previous episode, there is one point in it sort of script wise, which we could talk about in a moment, where I thought, oh, why did they do that? It's not as tricky as leaving the Gothic mansion during the Gothic Old Dark House story, but it is a moment where I was like, I'm not sure about that. But what else do you have?
Well, I think you're right that that Cal is a very strong lead in this series. I like Andrew Duggan as well. I remember him from 12 O'Clock High and from some other guest starring roles in shows like the FBI, and he's one of those actors that can play a good guy or a bad guy equally well. And even when he's playing the good guy, he's not always a pure as the driven snow good guy. There are some very sinister undertones in some of the characters he plays, and so it's kind of nice to see him in this role where he is a sharp, intelligent, good cop turned good PI, and that's rather refreshing, I think. And he's very good at doing it. But there were a couple of lines that he has in this that I really enjoyed because they bring out the flavor of the PI, the setup, very well. You remember, there's one one scene where the connection we've got, without going into too much detail, you have this young man who's just gotten out of prison, and his fiance his girlfriend is trying to connect with him, and he doesn't want anything to do with her, and so she sees Cal, or I guess that Cal actually goes up and talks to her, and he tried to help this young man out when he went to prison, and so she's asking him if he can find out what's wrong with her sweetheart, and he almost acts like a social worker. When you were talking about the this being a drama for the first half more than a mystery, he you could easily see this again where he is the social worker trying to help the ex-con mainstream himself back into a normal life. But he's talking trying to get through to this young man, and somebody says to him, it could be he wants to be left alone. And Cal says, could be, but I'd like to know why. And that's great hard-boiled detective stuff, but it's also what makes someone a good detective. He sees the what, and he wants to know the why.
Yeah.
And I really liked that. And as it turns out, you know, we've got kind of a failure to communicate here, I think, because when it turns out that when she's asked Cal to look into this, oh, by the way, she forgot to mention to him that while her young man was in prison, she got married to somebody else.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you know, there is that. And she said she waited, she waited about a month because he was sentenced to 5 years, and 5 years is a long time. And she waited a month, and he says to her, was that a 30-day month or one of the longer ones? That's another a great line.
Yeah.
So you can understand why the boyfriend is upset, because she got married. But then what she tells Cal that she hasn't had a chance to tell her boyfriend is she's also gotten divorced.
Yes.
So nobody knows all of the story, because she tells her boyfriend she's married. She tells Cal she's divorced, but she hasn't told either one of them both things.
Yeah, it's like trick, because it's almost sitcom-y, like something Lucy would do, or like I've been listening to a lot of Phil Harris and Alice Faye show lately.
Oh, and great
show. Yeah, and that has moments like that where it's just, if someone would just say one thing, then it would clear everything up, but there'd be no show. And so the first half is kind of Cal, he goes here, he learns this bit of information, he goes there. He relays this, learns another bit, then he goes back here and down. But as this is going on, this jerk is trying to get the place from Sharky, and Cal is getting beat over the head by one of the bartenders.
First concussion of the series for Cal. Yes. I think we're going to have to keep score through the run of the series.
I think they're going to be. Yeah, one of the things we do when we talk Green Hornet is we talk how often the reporter character Mike gets beat up. And we call him Poor Mike. And yeah, we could do the register how many times Cal gets hit, because Rex has a scene where he goes to that bar, Sharky's, and he's sort of standing on a dock. And I was convinced it was a dock. You don't see any water or anything, I don't think. But I was convinced that he was on a dock, like right on the edge of the water. And yeah, this big bartender comes out and tries to beat Rex up, but Rex takes him out with like one punch.
And I
like that, because it's sort of like, you know, Cal's got this sort of dogged thing he's doing, and he's thinking, but he can bring Rex along, and Rex, he can get that one punch in there, and just...
Well, and it was kind of like something you had mentioned about Rex in one of the other episodes, that you got the impression that at least part of the reason why he took the guy out was because he didn't want to get his suit messy.
Yes, exactly, that's... this is another one. I forget what it is he's making, but Rex is making something at one point after Cal comes back from his first visit to Sharky's.
Yes,
he's adding like beer to some sort of soup. I'm not sure what it is, actually. I didn't write it down.
I don't remember either. Of course, I'm no expert on Cajun cooking, so I'm not. I don't know if it was bouillabaisse or what it was, but.
I like the constant growing feeling that maybe Rex is more interested in cooking and making really like perfect. I like the concept of like the, you know, it's sort of like a, you know, Nero Wolfe is more interested in his orchids than
Rex is just a private eye in order to make enough money to support his cooking,
to keep him in bisque. Yeah.
Yes.
And I like it because Cal is much more focused on the detective. Maybe that's why he brought. Cal, like we mentioned in the first episode, I think when Rex was working, was it Sam? I forget the guy from the first one. And maybe Sam was more like pushing Rex to, okay, we're taking a case, we're doing this. But now he's like, wait a minute, Cal clearly knows what's going on, and he seems a little more laid back. You know, maybe with Cal here, I can start really working on the the bouillabaisse that I need to do. I can get that gumbo down.
So, in other words, what you're suggesting is that by the end of the series, Rex is Nero Wolfe and Cal is Archie Goodwin, right?
Yes, and Rex would just spend the whole time sitting in the kitchen area, and Cal would come in every once in a while. If he needs someone to throw a punch, he might have Rex come along, but he'd really just consult with them.
Yeah, yeah. And we know what Kenny is going to be then. He's going to be Fritz.
Yes.
That's
yes,
his role.
I hope he does get a role, because he really doesn't do. He mentions is the previous episode the one where he mentions that he's going to Notre Dame?
Yeah, I think so. Yes.
Yeah, and he was. They saw the Notre Dame game on TV, but he was sitting on the bench. And in this one, I think he mentions something about being the loneliest guy in Texas or something.
Yes. Yeah.
I like Van Williams, but I feel like Kenny is building slowly.
very slowly,
as we go along here. Let's see, what you know, I like, we haven't really talked about the Baron, who's the piano player in the band.
I don't like him. He is kind of a cross between the character who has all the answers and the character who kind of has this, you know, philosophical look at things.
Yeah, he's great. He's the piano player in the band, and when the show starts off, and Cal comes in to eat, they're playing a very sort of, I guess most of the time, apart from when Louis Armstrong does it, they're playing Stardust.
Mm-hmm.
And very sort of plaintively, and Cal's like, "What are you doing? Why are you playing this?" "Oh, it's for the lady," and that sort of starts things rolling. And the great thing is that at one point when Cal goes into this, and it's like, "You're going to Sharky's. That's one of the nastiest places around." And he goes in, and the jukebox is playing Jeepers Creepers. And it's like, "This is one of the nastiest places around. Jeepers Creepers. Oh my god."
You know, now this does sound like a Mel Brooks movie at this point.
it's just the way they describe it. And Cal goes in there and he's cool and he throws open the door. Bam, 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 bam. Whoa, hey, yeah. No, that does sound like someone. I almost feel like maybe in the script they had a different song to play, and someone who was doing the sound was like, "Let's put in Jeepers Creepers. Okay, let's do it." And they did that.
I would like to think so, yeah.
And the producer said, "Really? Really? It's too late for us to change it now."
Now, see, the difference is if they had, you know, if this was Maverick, for example, another Warner Brothers one, you would have gotten the reaction shot from James Garner.
Yes.
He would have come in there and heard that jukebox, and he would have given it that, "Oh, really?" look. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's... there's something about the mix of like the crazy Mel Blanc, that big burly bartender, these sad looking guys, Kip, I'm sorry, with his trumpet, and mm-hmm. just the song that makes for this strange. And also, all the extras outside of Sharky's are really great, like, sort of sea salty kind of guys.
Yes.
And there's one guy in particular when Rex pulls up, and they always get great parking in this, no matter where they are. I don't know what the parking is like in New Orleans, but Rex and Cal always get the best spots.
Incredible, isn't it?
Rex pulls up right in front of Sharky's, and he gets out, and I don't know if you noticed, but there's like one, there's an extra walking by who is very much sort of very much like an old sailor kind of guy with like a pack over his back. And he is walking so slow, and he is just milking every moment of walking by Richard Long, which I just love, where he's like, "Okay, it's almost like, well, we only have one extra. Have him walk real slow. Okay, that'll work." That's sort of the same thing.
A method extra.
Yes. Let's see. I've got one more thing I want to mention about this. What else do you have, sort of final? Well, final thing.
There was something I was curious about at the very beginning, I guess, mm-hmm. was that this young guy who is just out of prison is working as a musician at a bar, mm-hmm. and I'm saying to myself, would a parolee be allowed to work in a place like that?
Oh yeah.
Because usually one of the conditions of their parole is that they don't go anywhere where they're associating with various nefarious characters. I would think that a bar would be the last place they would let him work. But you know, I think that the trick to a good episode is that you think something like that and you don't let it get in the way.
Yes.
And so I didn't. I just said, okay, whatever. He's there in the bar.
To me, I thought it's all part of that Bourbon Street beat. Yeah, baby, yeah. here's something I love, and I realized they did this in the previous episode. They didn't do this in the first one, which I'm guessing is the pilot. But they do it from here on in. Something I love about this, and I I think they do it in the other the location detective series, but we're watching this one, so I'm specifically saying about this one. But it's great because it starts off Bourbon Street Beat, and you get the big music playing, and then you get the cast sort of walking down the street, starring Richard Long, as you know, Andrew and Arlie. But then it's great because when the show begins, you get the title come up, Torch Song for Trumpet, starring Richard Long. Andrew Dar- and I thought, no, you already said, we already saw them. Do you need to? And then the very first credit, the cast credit that comes up during the closing credits is all their names again. And I thought, wow, is there any other show where like the main cast gets sort of marked out like three times like that?
Credits by the Department of Redundancy Department.
I just noticed that this time when I was kind of going through the second viewing of this one, and I was like, oh, they do that on all of them. They just keep – I wonder if that's like a contract thing. I need my name on there three times. Okay, you got it.
That would not surprise me, actually.
All right. Let's see. Do you have anything else for this one, Mitchell?
Just that when we were when my wife and I were watching this, and we're introduced to Brad Dexter's character, Mark Allen, the guy who wants to buy out
– Oh, yes.
And she says that she just came up with this great description. She said, Brad Dexter is the poor man's Bruce Gordon. If you look at him in his pinstriped suit, and true enough.
Yes, yeah. I think when I saw him, I knew it was something like that, but I wasn't able to put together in my mind what it was. And it's like, it's great because the moment you see him, you're like, oh my gosh, yeah, you're so evil. And you're, and you're being evil to that guy. Why that guy? He seems so downtrodden. And although one of my favorite Cal moments is in this episode where he goes to – well, one of my favorite Cal moments maybe in this episode – well, no, I really like the way he's in the bar and he meets the bartender and he's leaving the bar. And then he hears Sharky talking to this guy and he just strolls right in the office.
Yeah,
it's just like he opens the door and walks in, and these two guys are, I want this bar, Sharky. I'm going to get to, who are you?
Yeah, oh, they don't notice him until they've just revealed the key plot elements.
Yes.
It's almost like it's for the audience's benefit.
Yes. But I do like that, because that's just Cal to me. He's like, I'm not going to say, I'm just going to walk right in. But and I will wrap up this discussion with the one thing that slightly confused me about the episode. But you do get to see in between these scenes, you get to see what Rex is cooking. But it's weird because Cal goes to the bar, meets like three quarters of the people related to the bar, but not Kip. He leaves the bar, goes back to the Absinthe house, talks to Rex, and then goes back to the bar and meets Kip. And I thought, couldn't they have done that? Because when he talks to Kip's lady friend later on, she says, did you go? Yeah, I went twice. And I thought, I feel like maybe they could have just had that be one visit. Like maybe Kip could have shown up at the end of it or something. Yeah, I just thought it was a little strange.
They do seem to be having that problem here in these two episodes, don't they?
Yeah, there's something like they couldn't incorporate, because the thing is, he's going to be here, but not for a few hours or something. Couldn't have been just like, oh yeah, he just stepped out. He'll be right back.
Yeah.
And he could have made, and he could have gone out into the street and met Kip. And they could have had a discussion out there. And then he could have left. Rather than he leaves, he goes all the way back, and then like a couple hours later, he returns. It just seems like, I don't know that we need that much. You know, it's one of those things where, like, the moment someone figured out in the land of movie making that in order to show someone, you know, like, leaving their house and driving somewhere, you didn't have to show them doing everything. You know, you could cut chunks out. You know, it was like that was a big moment. And it'll be a big moment in Bourbon Street Beat when someone realizes that you don't have – that you can cut out some of this bit.
Yeah. Of course, you know, in their defense, they're probably under tremendous pressure to pump out these scripts.
True, yeah.
But you are right that that is something that I think they need to become a little more cognizant of.
Yeah. And it makes Kel feel a little weird that, well, I mean, I could see, like, maybe if it was like, okay, well, I'm not going to hang around here. I'm going to go back and have some bisque or whatever that was Rex was making. But it does seem a little weird, like, Kel went, he kind of went home, and then he went back.
Yeah.
It's not his fault. But it seems a little weird.
He seems a little too dogged to be doing that.
Yes, yeah. Like maybe he'd find out where Kip was. You know, like, well, where does Kip live? I'll head over there and talk to him, something like that. He doesn't have to talk to him at the bar, specifically.
Right.
But yeah, that was the last bit I have on Torch Song for Trumpet. If you're all right on it, do you have anything
else? I am. You know, we talked about the third episode being pivotal, and I think that this is the one that tells us we're going to keep going.
Yes, exactly. And, we'll see. The next one is Woman in the River, which... I think it will be quite an interesting one, I think. So Mitchell, where if I were someone online and I said I want to find where you are, where would I do that to go to find the where you are?
You would go to itsabouttv.com. Name of the website is It's About TV.
Yay! All right. Thank you so much again for joining me in this. This is a good time. So, next time is Woman in the River, and
Bourbon Street Kinks.
In a matter of seconds, this contender will take his last count. Who killed him? Was it his sparring partner?
Hogan's dead, and they're saying I did it.
His manager?
I had the bottle. I made the kid drink it.
His fiancé?
We were going to be married after he won the championship.
The ring physician?
I'm just a transplanted country doctor.
The gangster?
How would you like to have your legs broke?
Or was it someone else? Match wits with Ellery Queen. See if you can guess who done it.
Episode 13 of Ellery Queen Mysteries aired January 11th, 1976, The Adventure of the Sunday Punch, directed by Seymour Robbie, written by Larry Alexander, and as you could hear from that opening, this is the boxing episode. The kid, the great young hope, the almost champion, is knocked out by his sparring partner during a sparring match and dies soon afterwards, and everyone comes under suspicion except Flanagan, who is in this episode. And Ellery and his dad join up and join sort of the world of boxers and fixed fights and mobsters and all kinds of fun. I think this is a pretty fun episode, and I'd like to transport you to a room where it's going to get talked about. Enjoy.
Something like this, you got to have a boxing episode. You got to hit all the different areas. You got to hit all the different spaces. I mean, so far we've had we had the New Year's episode, and we had an episode involving TV, and we had an episode involving radio, and we had one set in a swank nightclub, and you just got to hit all the bases. We had one with Pernell Roberts in a ridiculous outfit. Well, what are you going to do? So, Sunday Punch. This one is basically... As said, Eddie is the other boxer. I've got boxers' names aplenty written down. I do want to talk about Eddie, but you get the kid, Hogan, who is killed in the opening sequence. I mean, it's a very nicely put together sequence. I won't go too in depth into it, but it's. And basically, Flanagan is there, and he's goading the kid on, and the kid and his sparring partner are going away, and eventually, yeah, the kid goes down and he dies, and it becomes obviously a big to-do, and you learn it's pretty great because obviously Ellery gets involved the way he normally gets involved. He's not fully paying attention. Well, here's how he gets involved.
Sure you won't come along, son?
Huh? No, thanks, Dad.
Might be interesting from a research point of view. Prize fighter gets killed while training for a championship bout.
Some other time.
Well, if it ever happens again, I'll be sure to let you know.
Thanks, Dad.
You know, when you're working on a book, you're a great company. Of course, if I want conversation, I can always talk to the goldfish.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. On second thought, the goldfish might make more sense. Well, see you later. Don't overdo it.
Dad?
Yeah?
Are you going somewhere?
Whatever gave you that idea?
Yeah, so Ellery and Veeley and Inspector Queen get pulled into it along, of course, with Flanagan. And there's all the usual suspects in there, with one strange exception. I think it's a very nicely done episode, because it does that thing where the opening sequence, the boxing match, and then the subsequent death of the kid. And did I call him Eddie again? I forgive me. I'm just going to call him the kid. I got too many names written down here. The opening sequence, yeah, where the kid dies, is packed with all sorts of sort of wonderful misdirection and bits and bobs here and there. You're looking here, but you should have been looking there, and this happens, and suddenly this happens over here, and this is going on, and a bit of again, we're not here to spoil these episodes for you, but yeah, there's hell of a lot of nice misdirection, this, that, and the other thing kind of stuff. And I really think it's a nice mystery in this episode. It's a great sort of cast of people, from the coach Hatter, in fact, to like the doctor, the kid's gal, the sparring partner, the sparring partner's wife, girlfriend. I'm not 100% sure what the relationship is there. It's cool though, because she is the one who, when her guy is going to, well, get in trouble with the police, and by the way, Joe is the name of the sparring partner. I'm sorry, I've got Joe and Eddie and the kid and the this, that, and the other thing, and the Flanagan. But there was a great moment where Joe runs away from the scene of the death and goes to sort of see his gal there, who has her own salon. She takes Joe to see Ellery, because she's worked with Ellery. But, well, she was involved with something that Ellery was involved with, and she goes to see him, and that kind of embroils Ellery in a little bit more, which is fun. And then you get, of course, Flanagan. It's great. I think we mentioned before, Simon Brimmer always wants to solve the case. He always wants to best Ellery, and he never does. Whereas Flanagan just wants the headlines. He could care less who does. I mean, he put Ellery in prison a few episodes ago. He doesn't care who does what. He just needs to just get the headline. That's all he cares about. And they go to see Flanagan a little bit later, and they kind of listen in on him and his secretary talking about some facts in the case. And then they go in and have a chat with him.
I'm sorry, Mr. Flanagan doesn't see anyone without an appointment when he's working on his column.
Oh, he doesn't, does he?
It's okay, Vera. These gentlemen are friends of mine.
In a pig's eye. Now, I want some answers, and I want them fast. Where'd you get that information?
Sorry, Inspector. My lips are sealed. Hiya, Junior.
Hiya.
This is police business, Flanagan. I want the name of your informer in my department.
No can do.
If you don't give me the straight dope right this second, I'm going to haul you down for questioning. Now, I mean it.
Now, hold it, Inspector. You can't bully a newspaper man.
He's right, Dad.
I'm trying to keep the lid on a piece of information that could lead us straight to the killer. I'm not going to let any 3-cent yellow rag peddler mess it up.
Take that down. I may want to use it in court. You know, Junior, your pop's as batty as the Carlsbad Caverns if he thinks I'm going to lose a scoop like this.
Well, actually, it may not be a scoop by the time it's in the Gazette.
Why not?
Why not?
Dad, you'll want to play fair by giving the same information the other newspapers. Matter of fact, you may have more to give them.
Come on, Inspector. You're not holding out on Flanagan after all the support my column's given to the Boys in Blue, the Cop on the Beat, New York's Finest?
Oh, cut it out, Flanagan. You're breaking my heart.
Well, I don't see why a deal can't be worked out.
A deal?
What kind of a deal?
If Flanagan agrees not to use the item on the poison water bottle, you'll give him a break in any new developments in the case. What do you say?
Mitt me.
Mitt him.
The last time I shook hands on a deal, I was buying a used 1937 Willys. The engine fell out. Gimme.
There goes a headline story.
And of course, as always, random arrangements are made, and there's a great scene where they're looking through a stack of all the photos that the photographer took of the match right up to and before and after the kid going down. And there's some nice chicanery from Inspector Wayne on that part. And Ellery Ellery, yeah, sort of goes through the episode, kind of learning the bits and bobs here and there, and we get the great, and I don't think this is a spoiler kind of thing, but we get the great scene where Ellery is just basically out and about. We've seen in the beginning that is it the great Dick, what's his name, Bakalan? I've never said his name out loud. You know, the great sort of character actor who was in a lot of fun stuff. He plays, I believe it's him, playing the sort of not the hatchet man, but like the tough guy, the protector guy for this gangster. And at one point, yeah, they pick up Ellery, him and this other guy, and they take him to the gangster's home, beautiful home out in the countryside, and they talk about the kid, and they talk about boxing, and they talk about Joe. And it's really a nice sort of scene, you know, in the time this would have been. Well, this is early 76, so, you know, hey, you know, 2 years ago was Godfather 2, and everyone was still, you know, Godfather, gangstery, crazy. So it's fun to have the gangster in here. Of course, obviously, this isn't 1947 also, so that's kind of fun. Yeah, it's a super super good episode, and I think it wraps itself up really nicely. It has a very lengthy ending. It's not one of the, well, they generally don't have shorter endings on Ellery Queen, but it has one of the sort of lengthier endings where Ellery has them recreate the closing, which I like very much. Jim Hutton and David Wayne are just fantastic in the parts, and everyone's a really good guest cast. And I think my wife thought everyone in this episode was Ben Gazzara, but no one is, oddly enough. And I'm not even sure if he shows up in the show. He might. I've forgotten. Now, I want to bring up one more thing and then wrap this up, because I've actually had to edit myself slightly here because I keep almost giving stuff away and I'm trying not to. But I want to talk real quick about Eddie. One of the standard elements of all sorts of mysteries like this is pretty much everything that happens, apart from relating to, say, the detective and Inspector Queen. And did I call him Inspector Wayne earlier? If I did, Inspector Queen, say Flanagan and Veeley. I mean, those guys are not the killers. Those guys are not the bad guys. You know, sometimes they can sort of be brought in when you thought maybe Ellery, you know, killed Tom Bosley a few episodes ago, but he didn't. You knew he didn't, but that was just some sort of subterfuge. But every once in a while, you get a character like, say, Joe's gal. Joe's gal didn't do it. She wasn't anywhere near there. And most likely, the kid's gal didn't do it. She wasn't anywhere near there either. But in this episode, you get this really weird character. Well, not a really weird character. He wouldn't tell you he was a really weird character. A character named Eddie. And Eddie is sort of, he's a boxer. And he's a pretty good boxer. It looks like he's an older gentleman, probably, I don't know, early 50s or so. And he's a good boxer. He's good with the bag and the thing and the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da thing. But his thing throughout the episode is that he's starting to get like blurred double vision, and he's starting to get headaches, which is not a good thing for an older boxer. And he's sort of one of the boxers who never quite seemed like he never quite had his big break. And it's interesting because he's there the whole time. He's there in the opening scene. He's there in the final season. He keeps on popping up throughout. He gets the final moment, the freeze frame with Ellery and his dad. And yet, it's interesting because there is never, ever a feeling that he is the killer. Maybe there's a way he could be. He does kind of help the kid into the dressing room, you know, when the kid dies. But it's interesting because he's such a big part of it throughout, and they're constantly referring to Eddie and what's Eddie up to. You know, how is Eddie? Eddie's doing this. Eddie's doing that. Eddie has a big scene where he gets in a fight, almost gets in a fight with a younger boxer. And this Eddie's kind of like all over it. And Eddie is sort of like he's kind of like half Art Matrano, half Burt Young. And he seems a bit like he's maybe been hit in the head one too many times. And we looked it up, and because my thought was, so you've got a character like this in a boxing episode who is one of the boxing characters, but who clearly isn't a suspect and yet is with all the suspects. It doesn't make sense because, unlike, say, Joe's gal or the kid's gal who are involved, Eddie isn't involved at all. He's just a guy who's at this gym, and there are tons of guys at this gym. So why is this guy so important? We looked it up. Eddie's played by a gentleman named Art Aragon, who I believe did some acting, but he was best known in the 50s, I think, as a boxer. Which is interesting. I mean, because it's like they got a boxer. You know, it's like when they get You know, like that. There's that episode of Masquerade where, what is it, one of the people they bring on board for the heist is like Carl Yastrzemski or something. And he's not a very good actor, but he's a sports person, and you bring them on. And I don't know if folks would have known who Art Aragon was. Maybe they would have, but he's an actual boxer that they brought on. So it's interesting because he participates, but he's never an active suspect. But he has a big role in the episode. I just think it's interesting. You don't see stuff like this in a lot of mystery type things like this. I mean, you wouldn't, like in an Agatha Christie, you wouldn't see this. Eddie would turn out to have been, you know, the Kid Hogan's father or something like that, and you know, or his twin brother who had plastic surgery and everyone thought he died or so, you know, something like that. But in this, he's just kind of, he's this boxer who they hired and put in it, and they give him a decent supporting part. So it's fun. So I'm not going to spoil anything again. I am going to hop us right over to Mr. Queen. Ellery, take it away.
Now I know who didn't kill Kid Hogan.
Who didn't kill him?
I also know who did kill Kid Hogan. Now, Flanagan's picture and the way my dad pours milk in the coffee gave me the answer. Was it Joe Adams? Was it Sam Hatter? Was it Doc Sanford or Melinda Sanford? Or Eddie? Or was it somebody else? Now, bear in mind that the timing has a lot to do with it. Yeah, I'll tell you more about it at the gym.
Thank you, Ellery. Hey, everyone, it's Dan. Welcome to the end of the episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Episode 47. As I said at the beginning, normal programming should begin as per regular, with, of course, the addition of Mitchell, in the next episode. Forgive any glitches or anything with this one, my apologies. But I think it was a good time. Regardless, I think it was a good time. So, Eventually Supertrain, what's up? Where can you find us? Where are we? EventuallySupertrain.blogspot.com. We're on iTunes, we're on Stitcher, we're on SoundCloud. Any reviews or likes or anything are always, always greatly appreciated. esupertrain@yahoo.com is the email address. Eventually Supertrain on Facebook, @esupertrain1 on Twitter. Let's see what else. PolishAmericanGuyReviews.blogspot.com is my site, and that site currently still on BJ and the Bear. Sorry that right when I got started on BJ and the Bear Season 3, the book contract came through, and so that has sort of slowed me down there, too. So I've done the initial two-hour sort of soft reboot episode of Season 3 of BJ and the Bear, and the first regular episode. I should have the next one up hopefully soon. What else is going on? Good old Podcast Mania, if you can find out. We haven't done an episode for a while. Charlie's computer. Remember Charlie from Manimal, his computer crapped out on him. And so we're waiting for a new computer to show up. Made for TV Mayhem. I think by the time you're hearing this, we should have our newest episode up, which is, gosh, I forgot it. Propaganda with Go Ask Alice and Mazes and Monsters, which is a lot of fun. And what else? Of course, Bleeding Skull. You'll still find a lot of my reviews there. The Bleeding Skull book, the 1980s book. I actually have a novel called Arthur Bertrand and Constance on Kindle, which you can find. It probably needs a rewrite done to it because it's a few years ago. And my other book is 80s Action Movies on the Cheap. And yeah, thank you so much, everyone, for listening. And I'm going to wrap up this episode with a little bit of this.